I used to spend so much time tracking down high-quality learning experiences, especially once I started to move past the basics. But nowadays, man, you can learn things like design systems, storytelling, leadership, UI engineering, directly from top operators in the industry. And it's all happening on maven.com. That's even where you're going to find my advanced Figma training program. It's all cohort-based courses, which means everything's really hands-on. There's live sessions. You'll get access directly to the instructor, which means it's easily the best way to invest in your career. So head to maven.com to learn more. That's M-A-V-E-N. Okay, now on to the episode.
Very rarely are ideas bought in one moment by one person. Chances are you get one shot to say it how you want to say it, and then you're dependent on that person to re-articulate your idea in your absence. They take it to upper management, to a board, to other people in a different department, the CFO, whatever it might be. Now, this comes back to what do we remember? We don't remember fact after fact after fact. What we remember is the conflict bit. That's emboldened in our memory. So if you arm your person with the major piece of conflict and the way to overcome it, they are more able to re-articulate that idea onwards.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. Today, we're talking with Ian Wharton. Now, you might remember that name from the Michael Wandelmeyer episode because Ian was the storytelling coach that MetaLab hired. So a lot of this episode is about practical strategies that you can use to sell your ideas more effectively. But he's also the design founder of Aid Health. So Ian's gonna start this episode with a story of his own to share more about why he decided to launch a new startup.
So I've spent 20 years as a designer in the design and innovation world. And I've always had a lateral interest in how digital technology can support health. But really the inciting moment for me was I had asthma as a kid. Kind of relatively badly, but not severe. I wasn't in A&E every week, but it was bad enough to impair my life a little bit. I grew out of it when I was a teenager, which is very common. It kind of happens for a lot of kids. And then for just whatever reason, somewhat inexplicably, it came back in my mid-30s. And I was just reintroduced to all of the challenges of trying to manage a chronic disease. And it was, you know, annoying. I'm trying to be pretty fit and healthy. I work out 5-6 times a week. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I try and eat healthily. And there I am, you know, being hampered by something that hasn't bothered me for 20 years. So I saw doctors, saw GPs. There was one who gave me a peak flow meter, which is this little tube. It's about that long. And you exhale into it, and it's an okay indication of lung function. And I just remember asking the doctor, saying, well, great, I'm happy to do this. How do I get the results to you? And, I mean, he literally kind of threw his head back and said, oh, yeah, that's a good question. Just, you know, write them down. Bring them back in 3 weeks. And I just thought, I mean, like 2020, and we're writing stuff down on paper that I could make an error on or you could lose. So I essentially built the first stupid version of Aid in a spreadsheet. I put in all my adherence to my medicine. I put in any triggers I thought might be causing it. I captured all the peak flow readings into a chart. And after about 3 weeks, I took all of that back to the doctor and he said, wow, if only people did this. Like how much we could help them. And because of that stupid spreadsheet, we identified a trigger. And about 3 months later, I'm off the medicine. It hasn't bothered me since. So it was very eye-opening. And then you speak to friends and family, you realize there's a lot of people suffering with chronic disease and very similar stories, whether it's diabetes or hypertension or cardiovascular disease, and the challenges of getting information in and out of the healthcare system. And then you look at it from a macro level and you realize, well, there's 200 million people in the US that live with one chronic disease or more. Costs kind of 50% of hospital bed days, about $4 trillion to the US economy through lost productivity. So you realize, well, this is a rising human and economic cost. And fundamentally, one I think can be solved by product rather than anything particularly clinical. So we just, you know, made a bet. Let's see. Let's apply our experience, our skill set to this. See how far we get.
So I want to hear all about the journey, but let's talk about the skill set part first, because you have this extensive background in design. So could you talk a little bit more about that? And, you know, you actually have an Apple Design Award under your belt too. So who are you as a designer? Let's start there.
Very deliberately had quite a diverse career. And that speaks to something I fundamentally believe in, which is, well, certainly most creative people, designers I've met over the past 20 years, which is probably thousands at this point, including students and veterans, I don't really meet many of them that just want to do one thing. I mean, like, most of them want variety and to explore their creative breadth. But for whatever reason, they feel like they can't, or there's a kind of a fear of failure baked into that. But my background, I started in visual effects. I mean, I really started when I was 16 making websites for clients in my hometown. I mean, not particularly lucrative or glamorous, but that's when it started. And then, yeah, a couple of years in visual effects. And then from that point on, it's basically a mix of startup and design agencies. Yeah, I was one of the founding team of a startup in 2009. We made apps through the iOS App Store straight to consumer. I worked at a company called AKQA for 6 years, kind of built a team in London and helped open our office in Sweden. And then I worked for a kind of giant experience design and management consultancy. It was like kind of 20,000 people, $2 billion market cap, which was very different. And then after that, you know, that kind of overlapped with the starting of Aid. So yeah, real mix of product, a little bit of marketing sprinkled in, not that I ever loved it, but that was kind of part of my role at AKQA. And yeah, just wanting to build things that hopefully millions of people use every day, that either bring them a bit more ease to their lives, a bit more entertainment, or a bit more information.
You talked about this idea of like a sweet spot of ignorance when entering a new market, which I thought was really interesting. So can you share what you mean by that? And also maybe we can use this as an opportunity to talk about how you approached the R&D process for a totally new space like healthcare.
I genuinely think designers are one of the most suited people to pick big, ambiguous challenges and find a way to solve them, like societal level challenges. I actually think, in my personal experience, a lot of designers think there's kind of people over there who figure that stuff out. There's people over there who are, more importantly, more suited to solve that because they've got an education in business or in the market that particular idea needs to live in. And when those small hesitations are made, businesses don't get started, ventures don't get started. And I actually think design-led ventures, design-led businesses can massively outperform non-design-led businesses. So the reason for that is, and this speaks to Aid and why I think we started it and have got to where we have now. I mean, every startup is hanging by a thread, but to the point where we are now, we have taken a design-led approach to health. Now, and we get this from VCs all the time. We are rare as a business in health tech, relatively. So both myself and my co-founder, Brian Snyder, we are both product people. We're not clinicians. Now, we work with some outstanding clinicians, like national leads in their respective field in the UK. But we do things a certain way that a clinically led health tech company might not. And to give you one very simple example, we've involved patients from day one because there's a library of information we don't know. So we find out. We try and be quick learners and we find out. So we speak to patients. We understand what's holding them back. How are they living their lives? What tool would make the most use to them? What does it mean to live with these challenges? If you could wave a magic wand, what would that look like? What's your relationship like with your healthcare professional? How do you wish it was? And then we ask all the same questions to clinicians, and then we combine that knowledge, our own perspective, an assessment of the market, assessment of lateral markets, and figure out where the opportunity might be. So designers, I think, come with this degree of ignorance, which is, you know what, I don't know that particular field, but I come with all the tools to find it out. So what you hope for is you know enough about the market that you're entering to add value and approach it with a particular perspective, but you're not so entrenched in that market that you're unable to see innovation, you're unable to see ways of doing things differently. And that's that sweet spot. That's the sweet spot of ignorance, which I think designers have kind of inherently. It's part of the job, right? You see a challenge and you find a way to overcome it.
Can you talk about some of the business knowledge gaps that you've had to close on this venture?
So, I mean, where do you start, right? I wasn't taught anything in business. At no point in my design or creative education did someone sit me down and say, okay, I'm going to explain a P&L to you. I'm going to explain what EBITDA means and why that matters. I'm going to explain to you how to size a market, what your serviceable addressable market is. I'm going to explain to you capital allocation. I'm going to explain to you the challenges of employment law and retaining staff. It's an endless list of things. Now, the reality is, and I really, really hope that designers appreciate this, is all of that is either easily learnable or deferred to someone else. Like, that, all of those things sound complex, maybe scary, and some of it does seem scary, but that none of those things are the real barrier. They're just, to some degree, like, some of them are inconveniences, some of them are very easy to overcome, some of them are very easy to learn. And it's just way better to learn through a process of trying to do the thing. Like, there's a point when just reading endless blogs and listening to people on YouTube talk about P&L, it like doesn't get you any further. You just got to kind of go and do the thing. So the real challenge is there a need in the market? Has there been some kind of shift from a behavioral norm to now being an exception? Is there a market that's underserved in a certain way? And do you bring with it a desire to solve that problem so you can answer the question, why you, why now? But also, do you have the discipline and appetite to just find a damn solution? And every designer has that capability. And I wish this entrepreneurial gap in education could be closed a little bit faster. It's happening, just not fast enough, maybe.
What do you think needs to happen to speed it up?
I'm still a believer in higher education for creativity and design. I think I'm a dwindling group in that respect. But I'm still a big believer in university when it's done well, because it's this celebration of discovery. It's your chance to figure out what you like doing and why. But there are certain things that just don't get folded into it. And a good university course will connect with the industry. They'll actually put a real burden on the industry. Agencies, startups, funds, financial institutions, to impart that knowledge where the course curriculum can't solve it. I think that's a major opportunity. Just connect students to a wider slice of the economy, of the productivity of a market. And then maybe there should just be specific courses. Maybe there should just be specific online courses that universities tap into. Probably universities should, specifically creative universities, should have venture funds so they can back their students with their intellectual property they developed during their course. Happens all the time in life sciences. I've not heard of it once in the design world, in the creative world. There's no reason why that can't happen. So there's a handful of things, but I think the main thing, the key foundation, is designers knowing, okay, despite these gaps in knowledge, I'm still a force to be reckoned with. And all of that stuff I don't know, fuck it, I'll figure it out. You know, that's what we need, because it's very solvable.
I really like that point, because it's like, yes, there is an element of solving this with knowledge transfer. And even, you know, I have a friend, Steph Golick, who's working on this course specifically for design founders, for instance. And so like, there's that stuff is very important. But listening to you talk, man, the thing that I think a lot of people are missing is just this bias to action. Like, you see an opportunity and you just don't even think, you just act.
Now, I think that is the main limiting factor. It's a psychological shift, not a knowledge shift necessarily. I mean, I wrote about this in my book, which is now like 11, 12 years ago, which was, I genuinely think creativity is transferable. All you need is to just start doing the thing. This is, I'm being very flippant here, but if I wake up tomorrow morning and I tell all my friends that I'm going to be an eye surgeon, there's a load of things to stop me from being an eye surgeon tomorrow, right? I can't bring in patients and start just flailing scalpels around. There's repercussions, right? Whereas if I wake up tomorrow and say, you know what, I'm going to try and start a fintech company, or I've got an amazing idea that can solve some productivity challenge, or I want to make a film, I want to write a book, I want to make an online course, I want to start a podcast. There's no one hanging around saying, you can't do that. It's like, whoa, not for you. There's a group over here for that. The reality is, I've met so many people who, both students and people who are in their veteran years in professional creative life, who've said, you know, I'd really love to write a book, but I'd really love to make a film, but I'd love to do that startup, but. And that but is, I'm missing some knowledge. I think there's people who are more suited to do that thing. And the reality is, the second you do it, you are that thing. Maybe not professionally, but you're doing the thing, and the professional bit will come in time, probably sooner than you think.
That's really inspiring. And I think it's a big reason why I'm grateful to work in tech too, because I often see, even on like Reddit comments, and people looking at becoming a designer are like, you know, do I need a degree even? Like, there's no gatekeeping really. It's just like, can you just go do the thing? Just go build the thing. Like, just go build
just
it.
Go do the thing. Just go do and do the thing. And also, like, education, coming back to that briefly, I've never once been asked what my grades were in university. Like, not, I've also, of all the, like, the countless people I've hired at all these different agencies, I've also never once asked them to tell me their grade, because I think just the creative world knows, well, like, what does that grade mean? what employers care about and what people who can support opportunity care about is, what have you done? Like, what have you done? Show me the work. Tell me your thinking behind this work. When was that massive bit of ambition that failed or succeeded? Doesn't matter. Just tell me about that. That's what matters. And if you want to find collaborators, people to help bring your idea to life, it's purely the spirit. It's the spirit and the steps towards actioning it that is the valuable bit.
Let's go back to aid, because, you know, if we're thinking through this lens of taking action, one of the things that I'm sure that you had to think about pretty quickly is, okay, who do I need to surround myself with in order to actually get momentum and figure out what I need to even be working on? So can you talk a little bit about how you've approached team building?
I think there's a reason why most startups that are successful have multiple co-founders. It's really, really hard to do anything as a sole co-founder. And then there's the team that comes around that. So the first thing I did, the first person I spoke to was a guy I worked with previously called Brian Snyder. And I'd spent maybe a year working on aid and been in quiet research and development, just validating it loosely. And I messaged, so I actually sent him a Facebook message, shows the time. And I just, hey man, do you fancy working on an early stage startup? And he said, how early? And I went, like early. And as in, I have nothing. and fortuitously, timing worked out. He was leaving this startup he was at. He was a COO at a 10 million ARR business, doing really well. So that was the first moment. There's some stability in a joint approach to something. And then the next bit was, we needed advisors who had the clinical knowledge that we didn't have. So, you know, we had two amazing clinicians in the UK that mix kind of deep research experience and population health management knowledge. And then the people you need to pull the thing off. So our CTO, CPO, they were the next hires. And our philosophy about hiring is, couldn't be more basic, which is senior doers, people who can throw down, who've been around. Because Brian, that's what myself and Brian are. Like, I've been in roles where I haven't touched design, but I've still designed. You know, I've not been the day rate designer, but I've still put my hand on the tools because I like enjoy it. And I think it's also important. I don't think you can build trust from a team if you're 10 steps removed from actually doing the thing you're tasking them with. That always seemed strange to me. So very senior doers, align them on the mission, give them autonomy. Everything else kind of takes care of itself, really. I mean, in terms of like what you need to assemble to get something like aid off the ground, there's some like really pragmatic steps. Very early on, we chose the venture capital route. We didn't really have a choice because it's health tech. You need time. You need runway. It takes a year to build a complex product. You need to pilot it. That takes 6 months. You hope you get enough evidence to carry on. Then you need at least one real world commercial deployment. And then you need another year for the evidence of that. And again, you hope that's good. So there was no other way really about other than choosing venture capital. Now, if anyone asked me now, they were building a startup, I would say, go out of your way not to raise venture capital. If you can do it bootstrapped or with one friends and family round, do that and take a bit more time, a bit more patience. Because the venture capital comes with all sorts of traps and pains and stresses. And it has this illusion of being this sophisticated market when it's just absolute fucking chaos and just ungodly confusion. There's other ways, right? There's other ways. So I would always say, if you can bootstrap, but we're health tech, we had no choice, right? Thankfully, we've got some great investors, but that market is just hell on earth to navigate. So we had to convince VCs to part with, you know, a couple of million dollars. And our mantra is being as capital efficient as possible. So we didn't go out and raise a $10 million pre-seed round. We raised a $1.2 million pre-seed round, which is tiny amounts of money comparatively to what goes on today. I don't know why we have this obsession in society about raising money. That is not the goal. That is not the badge of honor. Making a damn thing that works is the badge of honor. The VC money is just a means to an end. It's a means to get the thing made. So that always confuses me. Hopefully with things like WeWork and Theranos and Babylon in health tech, that tide is turning a little bit. But to raise our $1.2 million pre-seed, we had 100 hours worth of pitching. 80 plus investors, some multiple conversations over the course of 9 months. That is the everything. If you can't articulate what you're building and why it matters and get people to rally behind it, it's all for nothing. Even if your idea is objectively titanic in its potential, if you don't get people around you seeing what you see, You won't get anywhere.
Let's talk a little bit more about that then, because you know, one of your superpowers is storytelling, selling ideas, and you know, there's obviously a lot of doing that in these early stages. Not only just getting the money, but like you said, like getting people excited to join the team or back you in some way. So let's talk about storytelling, because I think a lot of designers hear, well, the importance of storytelling, and it's so vague and inactionable in many ways. So can you help make effective storytelling practical for a designer who's listening?
If you're on the internet at all, and you're trying to look at how do I build a brand? How do I launch a product? Everyone will just say, you need storytelling. And like the flippant thing I always say is, that's as helpful as saying, if you're building a house, just use bricks. It's so vague and unhelpful, and we can be much more disciplined about it. So the first thing I would say to designers is, you do not need the full complexity of storytelling in order to succeed at your job. To effectively communicate your ideas, storytelling is this big and you need this much of it. Now, if you want to write a screenplay, then sure, you need to understand plot, the act structure, you need to understand character development, you need to understand how you move from scene to scene and construct beats, and you need to understand genre and a million other things. But for storytelling in terms of selling an idea, you need one part of it, which is the most important part, and it's called the inciting incident. The inciting incident is the single most crucial part of any story that serves one function, which is to arrest your attention, to make you stick around for the next 100 minutes of a feature film or 300 pages of a novel. And it's a deliberate piece of design by every author, playwright, screenwriter to capture your attention. And the inciting incident is the moment that happens almost always within the first 20% of a film or a story that turns the hero's world on its head. It's this major opposing force, the first major piece of conflict that the hero faces and then has to take action to try and overcome to address this major upheaval. Now, if you think about that and you care about the design and presence of the inciting incident, everything else you need comes out of it. So the inciting incident only matters if you create the world beforehand. So if you establish the world of the story and then you need to articulate your way to a resolution. So the example I usually give is Die Hard, which is for sure just the best Christmas film. And we can contest anyone that doesn't think it's a Christmas film, which is the inciting incident is the moment when Hans Gruber, played by Alan Rickman, steps out of the lift at Nakatomi Plaza and opens fire with his armed henchmen and take the Christmas partygoers hostage. Right, in that moment, John McClane, this off-duty New York cop, pits himself against the bad guys in overwhelming odds. Right, so from that moment, John McClane's life is turned on its head. He was not at that party to fight off bad guys. He was there for a completely different reason. And now we'll stick around to see what he does. The same thing is true when you're selling an idea. Now, we only care about John McClane fighting bad guys because we know why he's there. He's there to reconcile his marriage to Holly. That's why he's in California, not in New York. That's why he's at that party on that day when those terrorists turn up. He's not there to fight bad guys. Otherwise, we wouldn't care. We only care because he's now got to overcome this major opposing force before he can even begin the process of solving his marriage. So like when you're selling an idea, the exact same thing is true. Your hero is the people who will benefit from the idea. So in our case, it's patients living with chronic disease. Your established world is everything that is happening right now. So in our case, it's 200 million people living with chronic disease. Those numbers go up every year. No one's fixing it. It's an unsustainable trajectory of human and economic cost. Our inciting incident is science knows what to do. We have the medicines, we have the lifestyle interventions. So what's gone wrong? And the thing we haven't solved is patient engagement. We haven't given the patient the tools to solve their own healthcare challenges, to take more control of their health, to self-care. Let me tell you about Aid Health. That's the difference. Now, if you go into a pitch and say, hey guys, I'm going to tell you about Aid Health. We've built this platform that's a native mobile app for the patient, and there's a clinician platform that's browser-based, and here are all the features. All of that is completely forgettable. Processes, methods, frameworks, people don't retain the knowledge of. Conflict and the steps you can take to overcome that conflict, people retain, because that's how we've grown up. That's the lens of how we digest all of our entertainment and information. If you build the selling of an idea around that, that's the only bit of storytelling you need.
Can we take that and apply it to a more like micro and frankly boring example, because there's the high stakes pitches that you're talking about. And then there's also like the designer who just got sent a new PRD over Slack and they're working on some kind of, I don't know, email marketing sequence feature. And they're really excited about it. And they're trying to get buy-in. And it's just like, yeah, how much conflict really exists in this?
Whether you're selling an idea to the board of a Fortune 500 company and you've been flown in to some high-powered New York office with a boardroom of 20 people for an account that's worth $10 million, or you're trying to convince your manager why a certain design decision is the one that should be made, the exact same thing applies. So if you go in to the just your design meeting and say, hey, so I've designed this feature. I've placed this button here, and I've formatted these things, and this is the palette, this is the interaction modality, whatever it might be. You can go, okay, okay, yep, okay. Now, if you go in and say, so I've been really working on this idea. Let's just for a second think about the challenge that our user faces. Now, it could be speed, could be boredom from utility, could be fatigue from repeating other interaction methods from every other app that's out in the world. If you highlight that moment, even just briefly, even if you just say, like, the challenge we have is we're doing things the exact same way as everyone else. Now, in some instances, that's good because it lowers the barrier of educating people how to use our product. But the bad side of it is we're no different. We're not giving them any moments of surprise. We're not giving them any moments of thrill, or we're not illustrating our care for trying to solve for them. So this is why I've done these things. Let me take you through these three design steps. Again, very different. So I would say the application is no different. You just use more brevity, use less words. But I would do the exact same thing regardless of scale or impact. But one thing you said, which is really important, which is there's a stage, right? Every cultural illustration of pitching we have, all the really stubborn images of selling an idea. This comes to Don Draper, Shark Tank, Dragon's Den, all the things like that. They are not the reality of selling an idea. They are heightened moments for entertainment. There is a stage, there's a script, there's lighting, there's a camera, there's a crew. Those moments are manufactured to do one thing, which is to entertain the audience at home. The reality is when you pitch an idea, it happens in much quieter moments, and it's almost always a conversation. Now, you don't need to perform, you just need to converse. You need to just quietly, with brevity, elegantly articulate a challenge, a conflict that you've overcome with your particular idea, and just walk them through it that way.
I like the emphasis on the challenge and the conflict. It reminds me of something actually from just a few episodes ago. A researcher, Noam Segal, was talking about this pain and insight equilibrium. And he was basically saying too many designers jump right to the insight when the thing that actually sparks action and compels people to do something about it is the pain piece, which is definitely coming through in this conversation as well.
So you can say, so I agree. I have a problem with, now this in agency world, this happens with a classic strategy department point of their involvement in a project, which is, okay guys, we've got the insight. Now my contention with an insight is you can craft one that's brilliant, but you can craft a lot of them that are completely dull and don't advance the story or the desire to hear a compelling ending. So for instance, an insight is, hey Rid, there's 200 million people with chronic disease in the US, so we've made aid. It's like, okay. Or you could say there's 200 million people living with chronic disease in the US, and the one thing we haven't solved as a society, governments haven't fixed, is the bit of patient engagement. And what does that mean? It means people are isolated. It means people stop taking their medicines half the time. It means people forget up to 80% of the information they are told in a consultation, and they're left alone. 0.001% of your time over the course of a year is with the healthcare system. The rest of the time they're figuring it out for themselves or using Dr. Google. Let's solve that bit. Insight isn't good enough for me. It's like it's part of the equation, but it's not the whole equation.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm going to use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm going to use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm going to be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand-selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full-time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. Another thing that you talk about that I really like is that you're selling an idea doesn't often happen in this one instance of you just like making your pitch, but it's actually a series of conversations. And maybe actually the buy-in that you need, you're not even going to be in the room for. It might be someone else presenting on your behalf. So can we talk more about that through the lens of being a designer? Like, what are some of the ways that we can empower other people to share our ideas effectively?
Very rarely are ideas bought in one moment by one person. Now, you might get a chance to articulate your idea a couple of times. Now, if you're in the VC world, that certainly happens. You meet the analyst, you meet the principal, you meet the partner, the general partner, then you go to their IC. Tedious, you say the same thing over and over again with small refinements to meet the context of that particular audience. But if you're selling an idea to a client or internally, chances are you get one shot to say it how you want to say it, and then you're dependent on that person to re-articulate your idea in your absence. They take it to upper management, to a board, to other people in a different department, the CFO, whatever it might be. Now, this comes back to, what do we remember? We don't remember fact after fact after fact. What we remember is the conflict bit. That's emboldened in our memory. So if you arm your person with the major piece of conflict and the way to overcome it, they are more able to re-articulate that idea onwards. So that's the first part. The second thing is, there's an exercise we usually go through, and it's covered in the course, and it's called Reasons Not to Buy. Now, teams almost never do this, which is, generally speaking, people are looking for reasons not to do something rather than to do something. It's much harder for people to convey the wisdom and power of an idea when it's not their idea. It's way easier for them to say, yeah, it misses the mark on 1, 2, and 3. That's an easier cognitive battle. And that's how most VCs make their decisions. Let's find reasons not to invest in company 1, 2, and 3. So the main thing I recommend is, as a team, as an individual, sit down before you get anywhere near the room of pitching and spend deliberate time being uncomfortable, thinking out, gaming out all the different reasons why they won't buy your idea. Now, if you spend that uncomfortable time in advance, chances are you're taking away the tools they would have to talk themselves out of it when you're no longer in the room, when they're no longer wowed by your passion for the idea, when that's obfuscated from them. Now, like a good example of that with aid is the clinical bit, right? So me and Brian are not clinicians. We started a health tech company. That is a reason not to buy aid, potentially. Certainly for some investors, it was early on. So we address it pretty upfront. We say, fundamentally, we think this is a product problem, not a clinical problem. But by the way, we have amazing clinicians, clinician one and clinician two. So the reasons not to buy bit, I think, is crucial. You have to game out reasons why your particular audience might say no.
I love that. And I actually don't think I do that even near enough. Like, even with something as simple as a prototype, it's so exciting. Yeah, it's good. It's good advice. Like, it's something that I can almost just bake as a checkpoint into my own process of like, actually, let's look at this through the lens of what are the holes that other people are going to poke in this. One of the things you said to me is that you think you've had like tens of thousands of moments where you are selling an idea. And my hunch is that at least a handful of those didn't go very well. So are there incidents where maybe you failed earlier in your career? And like, what were some of the moments where you've learned from those failures? And maybe how has that informed your model now?
There's been a couple of moments, but the one that hurt the most, which was the reason I did sell the idea, was I spent 2 years of my life writing a animated 30-minute half-hour special. I graduated with animation. It's something I care about deeply, even now. And this was post when I left one of the agencies. 2 years writing it. Really, it's about 3 months writing the script. The rest of the time is everything else. And then I got two really exceptional exec producers on board, had an amazing an animation studio attached called McKinnon and Saunders that are renowned for stop motion. They did Pinocchio, Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which won the Academy Award. They're a Manchester, UK-based animation studio. They're absolutely incredible. Their workshop is the closest thing I've experienced to real-world magic. It's just remarkable artists. And we developed the film, we did the development, I funded that, it was about 30K of my own money. We had an amazing veteran Disney character animator called Borja Montoro do the characters for it. I had an amazing environment designer called Almu Redondo, who's now an Emmy winner, do some kind of character art. Everyone we put this in front of for feedback said, this is an exemplary project. The script is great. Totally get it. These people did not need to humor me. I'm not talking like my mum. We gave it to some hard-nosed industry execs who could easily have just said, oh, nice try, Ian, but now do the next one. I was convinced, to the point where I was convinced it was good enough to be BAFTA nomination worthy as a project. With everyone involved, with the right budget, that's what I thought we could achieve. Maybe delusionally, anyway. And then we went out and pitched it. Then we pitched it to Netflix, Sky, Amazon Prime, Apple TV, and a few others. And we just couldn't get the damn thing commissioned. We just couldn't get it made. I mean, if I'm being honest, I've never thought myself to have a problem with selling an idea. I've never thought myself to have a problem pitching. Honestly, it took me about a year to recover from that because so much of me went into it. So much of my hopes and desires were placed on that one project. And it absolutely floored me. I just couldn't understand what I'd done wrong. Or anyway, with the passage of time, about a year or so later, I just realized we didn't sell it. I didn't sell the film. I talked through the film. I said, this is the film. It's called blah, blah, blah. It's two characters. This is what happens over the course of the thing. This is the importance of design in the film. This is the animation studio. This is the thing. And it's going to cost a couple million pounds to make. I didn't sell it. So what I should have done was, when I went to see Netflix and Amazon and Apple, I should have said, great to meet you guys. Listen, the reason we're here is we haven't had an original animated family film at Christmas in the UK for about the past 20 years. What we've had is fantastic adaptations and sequels, mostly literature adaptations. But wouldn't it be great if, knowing there is this adaptation fatigue in the market, we gave them something truly original, fit for the medium, that could catch them off guard? Let me tell you about this animation. And I just didn't do that. And I forgot all the fundamental principles of what it takes to sell an idea. And I wasn't successful. And the feeling was so shit. I said, how do I not experience that feeling? How do I experience that as infrequently as possible from now on? And that was why I kind of put together the course Sell the Idea.
It's interesting to hear you talk about that story because it's clear like there was a lot of passion for the film and what you were working on. And yet now you have this piece of advice, which is basically that we should find a way to care less about our ideas. So what happened? Like, how did that jump get made? What led you to now lean into that messaging?
Overt passion in any given thing, as in like, this is the everything. This one project is going to be the one. This is the whole thing. This is the next stage of my career. I care about this so much. That leads to two things during the moment of selling, which is the first hurdle every idea faces. Like, forget the production, forget the budgeting, forget the launch and the marketing, forget all of that. If you don't get it past that first hurdle, none of that makes any difference. The idea is dead after that first hurdle. So my perspective is, if you care too much, you either do one of two things. You forget to sell, as in, I forgot to sell. I thought the idea was just so great that it would succeed by its own virtue. That I thought people would just intrinsically see what we all saw, and I didn't go through the motions of selling. The other thing I think can happen if you really care too much is you oversell. You start saying things that you think will lead to a sure thing when actually it does the exact opposite. So anytime we have someone who does a hard sell, you know, the caricatures of like the agent selling the car or the corporate stock, what happens in that moment is something called psychological reactance. So anytime we have our sense of freedom of decision-making being taken away from us, it triggers an immediate motivation to regain it. So if you deeply care, if you have this unchecked passion in your idea, you can step easily into the overselling, which, even if that's not your intention, you can be, you know, figuratively or literally shown the door. So I'm a firm believer in a certain degree of indifference. Just find a way to care about your ideas a little bit less, because humans are exceptional self-saboteurs when we want something too much.
Before we move on past the storytelling piece, can you tell us about the time that you pitched The Artist Will.i.am?
Some pitches are memorable for like catastrophic reasons, like the animation, and some are just memorable for other reasons. So it's funnily enough, my co-founder at Aid Health, this was the first project we worked on at the agency we were both working at. And we got a brief from Will.i.am, And the brief was to help him launch his new smartwatch that he was making. It was called the Pulse, P-U-L-S. And it was billed as this defiant market entrance that was coming from this creative icon. It was like a half luxury fashion item, half AI assistant. So you could argue actually way ahead of its time. We're talking like 10 years ago, maybe. And we, Brian and I, put together an honest to God pitch with conviction and enthusiasm to try and win this business. And it was more marketing than design. We're pitching a campaign to help him launch it. And we had a meeting with him, and it was in the Barbican Center in London, which is this labyrinthine, like brutalist architecture. And it we were in this lost, forgotten room at the back of the Barbican that was completely empty apart from four chairs and this foldable table, which is literally like 3 feet wide by 5 feet long. And Brian and I were sat next to each other, and then Will.i.am came in and sat in front of me with his chief marketing officer, and he was on his phone, so it kind of gave him a minute. And then he put his phone down and went, okay. Now, like, so we'd assembled a literal like six slide pitch deck, and knowing somewhat his attention would be strained at best because he's a busy guy. And I said, great, okay, we're here to talk about how we can help you launch the Pulse. And I clicked the first slide and I said, so our campaign is called Make Noise. It's like this very youth orientated, defiant kind of fuck you to the consumer technology market that was loud and brash and expressive. And we thought it would just stand out like a sore thumb in the market for all the right reasons. But it was called Make Noise. Slide two was a mood film. The editor at the agency cut this really beautiful mood film, which was loud and energetic, and it's about a minute long. So we played the film, and the film stopped, and he just looked up at me and just went, that's dope. And just didn't say anything else. I was like, okay. So I was like, great, so I'll continue. I clicked the next slide, and he went, wait. Reimagine. I thought, that's the name. That's the name of the campaign, Reimagine. And he made me go back and play the mood film again. And at the end of the mood film, I shit you not, he stood up in front of me and Brian, literally 2-3 feet away from us, and improvised and acted out this commercial that he was writing on the fly with gusto and energy, like pointing to people behind us who weren't there. And this went on for a couple of minutes. And he sat down, and I thought, okay, well, I've now got like seven slides about Make Noise, and I don't like, should I carry on? And he went, yeah, let's keep going. Okay, I was like, great, but cool contribution. Click the next slide. I said, so here's how we might deploy this campaign. He went, wait. Dream bigger. And I was like, I don't know what's happening. And then he stood up again, acted out a different commercial in front of us. This time he cast Leonardo DiCaprio as its protagonist, and it 2-3 minutes he sat down again, and I was like, that was great. His entourage seconds later burst through the door and said, Will, we've got a flight to catch, we need to go. So we stood up, having achieved nothing, having said at most 12 words, and I stood up and I shook Will.i.am's hand, and he looked me dead in the eye and he said, you look like Wolverine, and then just walked out the room. And we were left in this cold and forgotten room, not knowing how to get out, having achieved nothing. And Brian and I bonded from that moment on, to the point where, fast forward 7 years, we started a health technology company together. Now, there's lessons in this, right? And the lessons are, be prepared, right? Like, be prepared for what might happen. Now, had we sat down and done the whole reasons not to buy, thinking about Will.i.am, we probably wouldn't have got to the point of him acting out commercials to us. But we might have thought, this is a wildly creative guy, wildly inventive. We probably need to take a different approach to how we deliver our ideas, maybe in smaller doses, I don't know. But it's a reminder that, you know, when you're underprepared for the moment of selling, it's as psychologically and commercially disorientating as being told you look like Wolverine and then being left alone in an empty room.
Oh man, I try so hard to come up with segues and smooth transitions, and there's just none after that. Like that.
Where'd you go from Will.i.am?
Yeah, I have no. I've just doubled over laughing. That is, I'm so glad.
100% true story. Yeah, that genuinely happened. We didn't dream it. There was other people present. It wasn't just me. But man, I won't forget that.
Yeah, this is just going to be a train crash of a collision. There are two things that I want to ask you about before we go. I know we're butting up against time here. And they kind of exist outside of this realm of storytelling and also even like your career path to some extent. So can you talk about the importance of like projects and side quests that are happening outside of your day job? Because I know that that is something that means a lot to you. So maybe share a little bit about that and then like how it's impacted the broader journey of your career.
Yeah, without doubt. So projects I've taken on or started outside of my quote day job arguably have meant the most to me in the past 20 years. And you could argue they've made the biggest impact on me professionally over the past 20 years. The first Jamie Oliver app that we made in 2009, I mean, that was mostly designed between 7 p.m. and 2 a.m. and on weekends while I was working at a visual effects company. That went on, as you said, Apple Design Award, top grossing app of its generation. We got Jamie on the front cover of Wired magazine saying how he conquered the app economy. Phil Schiller used it when he announced the iPad on stage at the Apple keynote, and the stars aligned for us, right? But had I not taken that on, that would have been a massive miss in my learning in the project I've worked on. I wrote my book in my spare time. Sell the Idea was designed in my spare time. The Initiation of Aid was spare time. So my stance on this is, I think it makes complete sense. I don't know if it's controversial or not, which is there's an awful lot to be gained by working in a great company, for sure, especially if you're young, right? There's resources, there's network, there's ability to learn, there's real meaty challenges from some of the biggest companies on the planet. But I think a lot of creative people, a lot of designers, maybe particularly early on in their careers, through no fault other than having optimism for their employer, think that all of their hopes and dreams, design-wise, creatively, will be fulfilled by their employer. And the hard reality is, even great employers will fulfill some of them, not all of them. And I can say this from having been on the other side of the table as someone who has hired a ton of people and run a department. So my view is very simple, which is if your day job is giving you everything you need to be fulfilled, and fulfillment is a different definition for everyone, then that's amazing. But from experience, most people don't feel that way. So you have to do the thing in your spare time. I think there's one caveat here, which is I don't mean hobby. Like, I've played guitar since I was 7. I still play now. Playing guitar has... I couldn't tell you how little that has on my economic outlook for the rest of my life. But I still play it, right? Every now and then. So I don't mean hobby. I don't mean like a passion as a hobby. I mean, if you want to make that product, if you want to write that book, if you want to start that venture, you want to launch that magazine, whatever it might be, just don't wait for people to grace you with the opportunity. Just go and do it yourself, because I'm just afraid too many people think they will be graced with that opportunity by their, you know, benefactor employer, and it's just not the reality. And in those moments of that personal enterprise, you properly upskill. You really get to the meat of the thing, of the gap in knowledge, the thing you want to find out. And at some point, if you've nailed it and you've learned enough and the desire is there, you will turn that thing into the next thing, into the next day job, and then until the next time. So I'm a huge advocate of it. I know not everyone can. People have families, people have different circumstances. Not everyone has resources to spend 30 grand on a feature film. But the side projects, the not hustle, I'm not a big fan of hustle, because the definition of that is swindle and deceive. I was a big part of that in its definition. And I'm not a big fan. I think if there is something you cannot imagine working on, do not wait for someone to gift you that opportunity. Just do the thing now. Just start that thing now. And if it doesn't work out, kill it. If it goes somewhere, double down on it.
I love that that is almost like the bookend for this conversation, where at the end of the day, it really just comes down to action and just going for it and putting yourself out there. And everything you're saying is resonating deeply, because yeah, when I reflect on my own journey, the tipping points that exist in my career are always tied to that side project or that little tiny thing that I explored. That question that I asked myself, it's like, what would happen if I just tried a podcast, you know? And now it's literally my day job. And so I think it's so inspiring to hear your story And the fact that not only are you like, you know, writing a book and starting a healthcare company, even though you have no clinical background, but you're also actively exploring these different other pursuits. And so maybe we could even wrap up by giving you an opportunity to talk about your course and why you made it, but then also like kind of who's it for and what can people expect to get out of it if they've enjoyed this conversation.
So the course was, of course, born out of my lowest point creatively, which was how do I not do that again? So I was going to write another book and I realized I didn't want to write another book. I wanted to see if I could make something of quality in a different medium as a different challenge. So there was something in it kind of from personal fulfillment that way. But sell the idea is everything I personally know to be true to make the articulation of any idea in any industry, in any market, as successful as possible. And it covers three principles, really simple. It's principles-based training. It doesn't cover where to stand in the room or how to project your voice or whether or not you should do the superhero pose in the mirror before the meeting. They're all personal things. If you need to do them, that's cool. But it's three principles. It's the inciting incident, which is the single most important part of narrative structure, specifically so the idea can be easily retold. It's context, which is everything you need to do to bridge the two worlds between you and the person you're selling the idea to. And then it's the surgeon, which is a visualization technique to help you talk about your idea in a way that's most compelling, but in a way that isn't a performance. There's no theatrics involved. And it's 22 lessons. It's 2 hours. It's for people in the creative or design service industry. It's for early stage startup founders. And it's for anyone in a cross-functional team that needs to do any kind of upwards internal selling. And, you know, some of the best teams in the world have been through it. Everything from MetaLab through to BBC, Dyson, Wieden and Kennedy, all different mixes of independent studios to big network agencies and in-house teams at some of the best product design companies in the world. And my hope is that if someone goes through it, it puts them in a better position of preparedness, that they've given sufficient time and sufficient strategy to make sure their idea overcomes the first hurdle that might otherwise kill it.
Well, if you're listening to this and you're interested, we're going to have a discount code. I'll make sure that that's in the show notes and the weekly email. Ian, thank you for coming on and giving us a little taste and sharing more about your journey. It's super exciting to see what you're working on and inspiring to hear about just everything that you're doing. And again, like this bias toward action that's kind of guided you throughout your career.
My pleasure, man. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan. I think what you're doing is awesome. And yeah, really great to chat. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, each week I send an email to over 10,000 designers with featured resources and key insights that you can use to take a leap forward in your career. Head to dive.club/email if you want to sign up. I'll see you next week.